And this hour, of course, we'll take your phone calls with Adam Rutherford as we talk about his work creation. We'll do it all next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Adam Rutherford with us. Adam, so what could go wrong with the genetic engineering and the altering of things?
Well, it's a good question. And it's a question which is one that most molecular biologists and geneticists are slightly obsessed with. There are a number of possibilities about, particularly when it comes to genetic engineering of things that are infectious, like viruses or bugs that cause disease, that by accident or without, but not by design, but we render them much more infectious. And so in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of serious and pretty impressive experiments to actually do exactly that. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but there's been a number of teams around the world, one in the States, one in Holland particularly, who have taken various flu viruses, influenzas, that are not human transmissible. Okay. So they're bird diseases. We can catch them and we suffer symptoms, but we can't pass them on to each other. And what they've tried to do is to genetically engineer them so that they become transmissible between humans.
Why?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Bioterrorism? Warfare?
No. The reason is that we want to understand how this happens naturally, and it will happen naturally, because the way almost all flus come from really bad hygiene conditions in chicken farms, particularly in Asia and the Far East, but any place where chickens are farmed very intensively, they have flu viruses which are endemic amongst these populations. And they mutate. They mutate frequently and often. And the density of the viruses within these communities of chickens is so high that we see these things happening very naturally.
The chickens get the flu? Is that what happens?
Yeah, they're bird diseases mostly. Okay. And sometimes we can catch them. But for the most part, we can catch them and we have flu-like symptoms, but we can't pass them on to other people.
Uh-huh.
The problem really arises when they mutate within us or within the chicken farms and we catch them, where we can pass them on to each other. And that's how pandemics happen. And that's what we saw with the swine flu pandemic, which affected the States and Europe and the Middle East, and the coronavirus infections, which is currently happening within the Middle East. So the reason that these experiments were done is for two reasons, really. What the first is so that we can understand how it happens naturally. And once we understand how it happens naturally, we can begin to design drugs and treatments which protect it from happening naturally, because we understand the process. And the second reason we do it is because it gives us red flags. It gives us the opportunity to very quickly identify when this has happened in nature. Now, I argue quite strongly in the book that even though this sounds counterintuitive, actually making these things become human transmissible in the lab, which was very, very controversial at the time. But if we do it in a responsible way, and I believe that we did do it in a responsible, very tightly, securely controlled way in the labs, then we arm ourselves for when the pandemic strikes, when it happens naturally. Because the truth of the matter is, the problem in genetic engineering, the problem in the possible infections that will cause pandemics and wipe out large groups of populations, is that it is going to happen, but it's going to happen in nature first, right? It's going to happen because hygiene in chicken farms is of such a low standard around the world that they just become infectious breeding grounds for things which will ultimately kill us. Now, if we could make chicken farming much more hygienic and much better regulated, then we wouldn't need to do these experiments. But that's not how the world works. Right, we want to eat chickens, so we want to eat cheap chickens, so the mm-hmm. chickens get kept in bad conditions and fed antibiotics by the bucket load. And as a result, that's where the infections actually begin. So the scientific process is to try and understand the reality of that, is to recreate it. I think it was the right thing to do. I don't deny that it wasn't a controversial thing to do.
Let's take some calls here, Adam, but let me ask you this right before we do. When you were saying that they do this because they want to find out about the flu and how it reacts. Might there be somewhere on this planet a group of scientists who have a different purpose, and that is to try to destroy mankind, and they've been channeled by either governments or rogue nations to uncover this stuff?
Well, again, it's a good and serious question, and it's one that I address in the final chapter in the book. And the truth is, I think that it's just not practicable, right, to do that. So that here's a really good example. We sequenced the polio genome in around about the turn of the century, and since then, the technology has moved on to the extent that we could now probably assemble a polio vaccine from scratch, right? So you can order the parts, we know the sequence, we could you could assemble it and actually create a new polio virus from scratch.
Right.
The problem with, and that sounds like a terrifying thing to do, but the problem with it is it is extremely hard to do. And that particular example took hundreds of scientists, thousands of man hours and many years, and a lot of money to actually do that. Now, if you're a terrorist and your primary concern is to wreak havoc, then that's a very expensive and long process to go through it. I don't mean to be frivolous or in any way trivialize what happened back in 2001, but it is fundamentally much, much easier to hijack an airplane and fly it into a large building than it is to create a virus that is capable of wreaking havoc in the same way. The other thing is that viruses and infectious diseases don't respect borders. They don't respect cultural practices. They certainly don't respect race or religion. And there is very little genetic difference between most people on Earth. So we couldn't possibly genetically identify a disease that would only hit, for example, Christians or, for example, Muslims or Tamil tigers versus Sikhs. Right? That is just a genetic impossibility. So if your main goal was to wreak havoc by creating something that was infectious, we would not be able to control it at all. As soon as you released it, everyone's dead.
Okay, to the phones we go. Jason is in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jason, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to talk to you and Adam about just the craziness of DNA and you know, Adam, can you tell me the number of DNA sequences in rice?
In life?
Yes. The DNA sequences.
Incalculable. So the number... Hi, Jason. How's it going? Humans have 3 billion letters of genetic code, right? And every single human is absolutely unique in their genetic sequence, sheerly because of statistics. So your genome, even if you're an identical twin, is unique for the duration of your life. Not only that, for the duration of humankind's existence, and statistically will be unique for the whole duration of humankind's existence until we go extinct, right? And that's one species, and we don't even have the biggest genomes, and we don't even have the most sophisticated genomes. So you multiply that by the number of species that science has described, which is about 2 million, and we think that's an underestimate by about four times. We think there are about 10 million species on Earth. And we also think, get this, that more than 97% of species that have ever existed on Earth are already extinct. Right. So what we know and what we've described in terms of DNA is a minuscule fraction of everything that's ever existed. So the answer to your question is huge, incalculably huge.
What is the difference between primordial soup, Adam, and primeval soup?
Oh, nothing. Actually, nothing.
It's the same, isn't it?
So it's just the same word. It's just the same idea, but a different way of saying it. Yeah. Primeval means first time. Primordial means first order. So it's same concept.
See, I'm convinced that soup is the same throughout the universe. Very rarely do I think it changes.
Yeah, well, it's a It's an interesting question, this, and one I spend quite a lot of time in the book arguing that the concept of the primordial soup is wrong and is not, it cannot be the origin of life on Earth. And the reasons, rather tediously, are to do with basic physics and chemistry, which is that once that reaction happens in a soup, in a warm pond is how Darwin described it. Once that chemical reaction has happened, when you get the ingredients right, it won't happen again, right? Because that's how chemistry works. Things don't react if they don't want to. So the soup, what we say is the soup is only ever going to get cold, okay? That's why I sign up to the idea that life didn't begin on the surface in a primordial soup, but began at the bottom of the ocean where it was being a constant disequilibrium of energy. So a constant imbalance of energy is being maintained by the Earth being active. So it pumps up gases from the sea floor and forms these insane rocks, which are called white smokers, and they have pores in them, which are about the same size as cells. And all the gases flowing around, which are continuous, would generate the first signs of metabolism. So before DNA, before cells, before cell membranes, before any of the things that we recognize as life itself, we think that it started off with being a chemical reaction that was continuous. Because that is what life is. It is a continuous chemical reaction.
Changing and evolving as it goes, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think the best place, we started this conversation by talking about the rest of the universe. The best place, the place we should be looking for life off-world, off the Earth, is not Mars, where it may once have existed, but one of the moons of Jupiter. And the two best candidates are...
Europa.
Enceladus and... sorry, what did you say?
Europa?
Europa. Europa is if I was in charge of NASA's budget, I would throw everything at Europa.
Yeah.
And the reason we think this is because it has a it looks like it's got an atmosphere, it looks like it's got water oceans, it looks like it's got plate tectonics, which means that it's unstable at its core, which means it's generating lots of chemical activity in its center. And the conditions on Earth that gave rise to life were similar to that. Atmosphere, water, oceanic vents, and as a result, life on Earth. So Enceladus is another good example. It's a bit small, but it's definitely got water, and it does these crazy jets where it shoots off water and methane into the solar system with regularity. Mars is a dead planet. It's important that we do go there and do explore and look at the conditions that planets are like. But I think Europa is a much, much better target if life is what we're looking for.
Remember Space Odyssey. Stay away from
Europa. Of course. Exactly. Well, Arthur C. Clarke was smarter than we all give him credit for.
Let's go to Robert, truck driving in Michigan, east of the Rockies. Robert, you're on with Adam Rutherford. Go ahead.
Hey, Robert.
Yeah. How are you guys doing tonight?
All is well. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Hey, it's 8 o'clock in the morning here.
Yeah, I got a couple of quick questions. What your thought is on global warming, and number two, you were talking about the Big Bang Theory and all that, and I was just, it just seems like the Earth is so perfect. You got the sun for the warmth and to grow everything during the day, and then you got like a nightlight, you got the moon. It was almost like it was set up for us for the purpose of us, being here, And I would just thought, I would throw that at you to see what your thoughts were on that.
All right, let's try the global warming one first. Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, there's a bit of a fuzzy line, George. Like, if you could just repeat the question.
Yeah, he wanted your thoughts first and foremost on global warming.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we have our own views, but hey, you know what? I want to hear yours.
Well, I take the scientific consensus on this. I think the evidence for global warming is overwhelming. It is a fact that the Earth is getting warmer, It is a consensus, a scientific consensus, that it is getting warmer as a result of human activity. And that is my view on the subject. I also think from a policy point of view, what we should do, I think it would be smart to play devil's advocate. And by that, what I mean is that if you were taking a bet on this, and if you draw these options out on a table, like a 2x2 table, right? If global warming is not happening and we do nothing, then the consequences are zero. If global warming is not happening and we do a lot, then what happens is we spend a lot of money,
right?
But the consequences are zero. If global warming is real and we do something about it, then that's the best possible option. And if global warming is real and we do nothing about it, then we're really screwed. So I'm not really a betting man, and you can see why, because of those options, only one of them seems plausible to me.
I've got a strange theory, Adam, about this planet and intelligent design, and it has to do with rain. I mean, let's say all our plants must have water in order to survive. Who in the heck would design a planet to make it rain when it's supposed to keep these plants alive? Trees, the grass, you name it. It does it. Now, isn't that weird when you think about it?
Again, we sort of touched on this at the beginning of the conversation. It depends on how you look at it. It's a perspective thing. So if we look at the Earth and say, well, it is perfect, like Robert said, it's incredibly perfect for life as we know it. And you know, we behave in a way which fits our environment very well. But that's because evolution has had a lot of, from my point of view, from a scientific point of view, that's because evolution has had a effectively infinite number of goes at getting it right. I think it's often difficult to process the amount of time the Earth has existed. And so as an iterative process, as a way of just testing the same thing over and over again. And like I said, actually, in response to Jason's question, almost every species that has ever existed on Earth is already extinct, and so has effectively failed.
That's true.
And our duration on Earth is a blink of an eye, a heartbeat, you know, a flap of a butterfly's wing. And we have done very well in that time. But evolution is blind. It has no plan. What it does is it tries things over and over, and things survive for as long as they can, and then they go extinct. And if there's one constant on Earth, it is that things go extinct. And that's something that we should always be very aware of.
Adam, where do people get your book, Creation, out there in the stores now?
It is. It came out last month in the States. I believe it's available at all of the normal sources. It's published by Current, which is part of Penguin.
Adam's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. We're going to come back in just a moment. We'll take final phone calls with him as we talk about creation and how science is reinventing life itself. I find it fascinating that science changes and manipulates things, and the outcome, of course, whether it's good or bad, who knows, but they do it, and I think they're going to be doing more of that. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll talk about global instability, how it affects you, and also a little look at neuroscience as well on Coast to Coast AM. And if you're out and about, away from your radio, don't worry. If you have a phone with you, or if you're near a computer, just go to iHeartRadio.com or download the apps in the iHeart stores. That's simple as that. Welcome back. Our final segment with Adam Rutherford, his book, Creation. Adam, what do you think the planet will be like 20 years from now? What changes will occur?
Well, that's a great question, and if I get my crystal ball out, one of the things I've described this revolution that we're undergoing in biotechnology is that it's kind of like the Industrial Revolution of the 18th and 19th century. I think we're going to see more and more emergence of using biology as tools, the redesigning biological systems in order to produce drugs, fuels, medicines. And all these things have already begun. There are, you know, we are already capable of producing diesel from bacteria or from yeast cells that have been genetically modified, we are seriously talking about significantly producing foodstuffs or ingredients for food using genetically engineered organisms. The same goes for medicine. Even NASA are taking this extremely seriously and investigating how it's possible to use engineered biology to help us explore other worlds. I mean, they're not there yet, but they're thinking about it. And it's based on this whole principle that evolution has had a 4 billion year head start on us when it comes to getting things right, getting things optimized for purpose. And in the last 30 years, we've begun to tap into that. We've begun to understand how we can utilize those tools that evolution has provided and redesign them for specific purpose. It's the beginning of this revolution, but I have no doubt that it is going to be the dominant technology and therefore business for, you know, the foreseeable future, the next century.
I mean, I see us in flying cars, cars that drive themselves. All kinds of technology, I think, will affect us, too.
I think it's going to be a lot less dramatic than those sorts of things. I mean, I can't wait for the flying car, although the air traffic legislation is going to be an absolute nightmare.
A mess. Yeah.
What I think we're going to see is labs emerging, startup labs, homegrown labs, people working in their garages, people working in their bedrooms, that are redesigning very specific things, right? So, you know, health inequity globally is an enormous problem, as we know, and most of the diseases that affect most of the world are not the diseases that we spend the most money on in the West. So I think we're going to see many people trying to tackle things like malaria and other infectious diseases that are endemic around the rest of the world. They're going to start tackling them in new ways, and the entry level for sophisticated genetic engineering is getting down and down and down. And I think we'll be treating ourselves with, you know, living organisms rather than taking pills relatively soon.
Let's go to Johnny now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Johnny, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Adam. It's an honor to talk to you.
Likewise, Johnny.
I had a couple of questions. I could actually talk to you for hours, but I'll make it short. I'm actually a Christian, but I'm actually very interested in the things that you're talking about. I've actually been very interested in it for a while. But I did have two questions. I will comment and leave a question afterwards, and I'll take it off there if that's okay. The first one, there was a model created just recently about the Big Bang Theory. And evidently, the Big Bang Theory reached a level of instability and collapsed. So as our Earth and the way that we were created was not a question of did the Big Bang Theory actually happen. The question is, how did we survive the collapse of the Big Bang Theory? And then the next comment and question is, I'm not exactly sure how to say the word, but it's the Eve gene. The Eve gene back in, I think it was the 80s or the 90s, it was discovered that there was one common ancestor for all women. And I've been very interested in this, and I've been trying to figure a lot of it out. But does it make a lot of sense that one woman traveled around Africa and mated with men? Is that why we have that gene? And I'll get off there and take your question.
Okay. Both good questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, again, like you said, the Big Bang Theory is not my area of expertise, but I think what you might be referring to is the model predicts the way the Big Bang will pan out over the course the rest of time. Is that one idea is that it will then collapse in on itself, and that's referred to as the Big Crunch, right? So its gravity will expand to the point where it won't be able to expand any further, and then will begin contracting until it becomes again a singularity. I think it's not something that we need to worry about right now, because it probably won't happen for another 20 billion years or so, even if it does happen. So surviving it isn't, you know, we don't need to worry about surviving that. We need to worry about surviving the next 200 or 300 years before that comes up. I realize that's a kind of glib answer to it, but most of the, you know, the scale of the universe is such that the timescales we're talking about are impossibly large to calculate. So that's one thing. Now, I didn't quite hear the second question.
He was talking about a single woman may have been the mother of civilization.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, this is I think maybe what Johnny's referring to is what we sometimes call mitochondrial Eve. Okay, and this is this idea that there's a bit of our genome which we only pass down through the maternal line. So I have the same mitochondria, which is this little bit of the cell, as my mother, and that was passed down from her mother, and it goes back all the way. Now, if you trace that all the way through humanity, it's possible to come back with this sort of concept that there was one, that there was a source for all of these mitochondria. Now, that's a sort of simplification way of telling the story, which is meant to be easier to digest than the complexity of the story, which is that it's not quite true. It is true that we pass down these mitochondria from down the maternal line in the same way that men only pass down their Y chromosomes from male to male. But I think that the thing that Johnny touched on, which is really interesting and is definitely true, is that almost all humans on Earth are derived from a very, very small group of people. So what happened about 70 to 100,000 years ago is that a small population emerged out of that, emigrated out of Africa. And everyone on Earth who is not from a direct African descent is descended from this one group of people who left Africa. And the estimates of how big that population are small. You know, some people have said it's as low as 5 or 10,000 people. So everyone on Earth, apart from people of African descent, have emerged from this very, very small group of people. And that kind of makes sense in a way, because when we think about family trees, right, you know, we have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so on. But if you keep going like that, if you keep going back, doubling the number of people every single generation, before long, in fact,
you've got a lot of people.
Well, you've got more people that have ever existed on Earth.
Yeah.
So, you know, the estimates of the number of people that have ever existed is around 109 billion, right? There are currently 7 billion people alive. We think that there are about 109 who have ever existed. If you keep doubling the number of parents every generation, by the time you get to the 10th century, you know, around about the time that the Normans were invading my country, there are more people than have ever existed. And we actually know there were, you know, only a few million people at that time. So what that means, and I think this is the interesting bit about what Johnny from Knoxville was saying, is that what it means is that not very far back in all of our family lines, we start interbreeding with each other within families. And we are, I don't mean this in a trivial, bizarre way. Insulting way. It's just true. We are incredibly inbred as a species. Sometimes geneticists like to quote that if you're sitting in the UK, it's different in the States because your pattern of migration has been different. But in the UK, if you sit in an audience of 100 people and most of them are white, then you're almost certainly sitting within two seats of your sixth cousin.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And in fact, everyone on Earth is less than a 50th cousin. So, I'm probably, at a guess, I'm probably, you know, your seventh cousin, and I may be Johnny's sixth
cousin. Adam, well, my cousin!
I know. Finally, after all this time, we meet. But it's the same for everyone, and it's because we started as such a small population.
Now,
isn't that crazy?
You said in the audience, if you're white, six probably generations. What if you're African American or something?
Well, slightly different story again, because the centrality of Africa as being the origin of human life on Earth, but then the migration, primarily through slavery over the previous centuries, has caused what we refer to in genetics, it's called admixture, and basically it is mixing with, it is different ethnic groups breeding with each other. And this is really interesting. This is what my next book is about, in fact, and I'm covering the history of America from genetics in one of the chapters. But there are simply no pure races at all. In fact, we don't really know what a race is. There isn't a biological definition of a race. We see differences between people, and those differences sometimes can be accounted for in our genes, in our genetics. But because... Well, there's no polite way of saying this. Because humans like sex, over the centuries and over the generations, we have mixed it all up in a way which makes it impossible for us to say anyone is pure this or pure that.
That's gone. Yeah.
And when we look at the genetics of it, that's what it says. And so it's quite fashionable these days to get your genome sequenced, and for a company that you pay, you know, $400 for, will tell you, well, you came from, you know, Viking stock via Germany.
Yeah.
Or you come from
Iceland. But
that's
fascinating. It really
the history is fascinating, but the mixture means that it's just, you know, it doesn't really tell us anything about us. It's just, they're sort of really interesting stories, particularly interesting for Americans because we've got better records because it's a, you know, relatively modern country.
Let's go to Manny in Sandy, Utah, first-time caller. Manny, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Great show tonight.
Thanks for holding in there so long. Go ahead.
I have a PhD in the pharmaceutical sciences, and which means I've worked in both biology and chemistry. And I say the following just to let you know that I've been successful in my career. So I'm an inventor of an FDA-approved drug that's now selling over $1 billion a year.
Good for you.
And that lets you know that I've had a chance to interact with people in many levels in the sciences. And before I got into sciences, I had no idea that there were people at the top of science, some of whom have godlike egos. And I can't describe this to people who've never seen that. It really is amazing to behold. These people are, for the most part, atheistic. And the Darwinian theory feeds right into their ego. And these people control a lot of the media perception. And I'd just like to say that Darwin did make contributions to science, but he was not a molecular biologist. He had no idea what a gene was or how it worked. So what he discovered was natural selection. And that's why we still refer to the theory of evolution, because in my experience, the creation of new species requires new genes. And just to give a concrete example of this, you know, we've been breeding dogs quite unnaturally and at a greatly accelerated pace for thousands of years all over the planet. It's given rise to innumerable varieties of dogs, and yet every dog on the earth is still a variety of wolf. And the same is true with people and their great variety. And what defines a species is that individuals within the species can interbreed within the species. However, in all that time, there's no introduction of new genes into the dogs, and there's no introduction of new genes into people. And so we remain
isolated. Can I interrupt you and just say that? So a lot of what you said is true there, there is no doubt about the nature of egos at the top of science. I couldn't possibly argue with that whatsoever. But in fact, we do have very concrete examples of the introduction of new genes, both through evolution historically and in contemporary circumstances. The best one, the one that I always talk about because my PhD was in eye research, is that we see a very easy and clear transition between the creation of new genes, which give us trichromatic vision, our ability to see color in three colors. Because if we look at our ancestors that are simian, that are ape-like, some of them only have two. And if we look at the position of those genes, they're called opsins, you see that one is clearly historical to another, and that both of those have been duplicated in our genome. And that is that process where you have the creation of new information by errors in genetic reproduction is the creation of new information. So we do see the addition of new genes to genomes all the time. In addition, like in humans, we now know through sequencing the human genome that up to 10% of our genome is actually from viruses that have infected us and lodged themselves in our genome and have then become part of our genetic makeup. So we also see the introduction of new genes from external sources too. So that transition from one species into another often involves the slow mutation of individual genes that we already have, but it also includes the gross mutation of genes. That means you're simply adding more information, and therefore you're giving evolution a platform on which to develop.
Adam, the first humans, the Adam, the Eve, let's say, as they developed, were they little tiny infants? And then how did they take care of themselves?
Well, no. So that they're because evolution is a slow and iterative process, it's really hard to actually say what the first human was. What you have is a continuous transition of one species into another. And whatever you know, 10 million years ago, that species was an ape-like ancestor. Right. And they were, the adults would have sex and reproduce and produce a child, which would then grow up. And at, over time, that process changes the offspring to the to the point where one day, over millions of years, you know, modern humans in our current form, current physical form, date to around about 200,000 years ago. But the transition is that at some point, the offspring are slightly different from their parents.
So it was just a slow evolving process, I guess.
Exactly, exactly. So there isn't a point where we can say, bang, this is
right.
This is where.
Unless you believe in the Bible and there it was, right?
Well, yeah, yeah. If you believe in the literal interpretation of
Adam
Genesis,
yeah.
then you have two individuals created from scratch. That's a good. That's an interesting narrative and tells us lots about our storytelling ability and culture. It isn't something that is supported by science.
Adam, we've crashed your website, but I'm sure it'll get back to normal by tomorrow. Sorry.
Well, that's great news.
That's right. And good luck with everything you do. Keep in touch with us. I enjoyed our chat tonight.
That was great. Thank you so much, George. It's nice to have the time to talk about it in depth.
Absolutely. Adam Rutherford, his book, Creation, How Science is Reinventing Itself. Now, make sure you're part of our Coast to Coast program for the rest of the week. We will have a live program for you on Independence Day, okay? We're going to have a secret door for the first couple hours and then open lines. So make sure you're part of the program for that as well. Live program on the holiday. That's the deal, and we won't let you down. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.